If you experience your work as a calling, do you view it as a net positive or a net negative? Our guests today have discovered that a calling can be a double-edged sword, both binding and ennobling. So how can you make your calling less binding and more ennobling? The answer to this question is the Zookeeper Secret. We'll explain in today's episode with help from Dr. Stuart Bunderson and Jeffrey Thompson, eminent scholars in research on work as a calling. Welcome to the Purposeful Work Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Dick. The Purposeful Work Podcast is brought to you by Pathway U, an online career assessment system that uses predictive science to help you find joy, meaning, and purpose in your career. For more information and to join, go to pathwayu.com. That's pathway, then the letter U.com. Our guests today are Drs. Stuart Bunderson and Jeffrey Thompson. Stuart Bunderson is the Bauer Professor of Organizational Ethics and Governance and the Director of the Bauer Leadership Center at the Olin Business School at Washington University in St. Louis. Prior to his academic career, Stuart worked in organization and management development at PepsiCo. His research examines leadership, team performance, and meaningful work. Jeff Thompson is professor at the Marriott School of Business at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. Prior to his academic career, Jeff worked as an organizational development analyst at Payless Shoe Source. His research addresses meaningful work, values in work, and employee productivity. Together, Stuart and Jeff recently hosted a conference at Washington University, sponsored by the Bauer Leadership Center, that brought together 17 of the world's top scholars on work as a calling. Stuart, Jeff, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You guys are two of the top scholars on meaningful work, but I know you're good friends as well. So take us back. How and where did the two of you first connect?
Stuart and I first met, as we were PhD students at the University of Minnesota. Stuart got there a couple years before I did. And so he kind of took me under his wing, and we ended up working on similar projects. Kind of discovered that we both spoke the same language when it comes to research. We were both really interested in what motivates people and in how people find purpose and meaning in the work that they do. And so it was just kind of a natural connection. And from there, friendship grew. Our families are dear friends with each other. Our kids consider one another cousins. It's been really a blessing and wonderful thing to have a friend like that in the field.
Definitely. That matches with how you remember it, Stuart.
I don't know what he's talking about. No, that is absolutely true. It's been such a wonderful relationship, and not just a professionally productive, but our families really are dear friends, and so is Jeff.
That's fantastic. It is such a blessing in this line of work to have that kind of not just professional relationship and collaborative relationship, but a deep friendship and admiration. And, you know, that just watching you guys interact with each other, that really shows and is just a huge blessing. Now, speaking of collaboration, in 2009, you guys published a classic paper in Research on Calling in the journal Administrative Science Quarterly. And this study is now famous. It's known as the Zookeeper Study. And you guys gave it a provocative title. So the title was The Call of the Wild, Zookeepers' Callings and the Double-Edged Sword of Deeply Meaningful Work. It's a fascinating study of joy, moral duty, personal sacrifice expressed by zookeepers. And I know there's a story behind it. So tell us the story of this study, starting with this question of how you became interested in zookeepers in the first place.
So that's funny. People always ask us that question, and it's a great question. I'm sure I would ask the same question if I read a paper on zookeepers in an academic journal. Jeff and I, we started with an interest in people who work for reasons other than just the financial or the instrumental. We were fascinated by people who work because they believe in a cause, something bigger, an ideology. And we actually wrote a paper on that in the Academy of Management Review. It's a theory piece where we talked about and theorized about how these relationships would work when people work for organizations for a cause. And then after publishing that piece, we thought, okay, now we need to study this someplace. Where can we study this? Where can we find a sample where people seem to work not for the money, or for some personal benefit, but because they believe that by working for their organization, they're actually promoting a cause. And about that time, we came across zookeepers. I recall listening to an NPR broadcast. Vicky Croak had just written a book called The Modern Ark that was about the evolution of zookeeping, and zoos had evolved from organizations that kept animals in enclosures, cement iron bar enclosures for really the spectacle of it. Zoos are really old institutions, hundreds of years, but over those years, they've evolved now to become organizations that are really leading the global effort to preserve biodiversity. And that evolution was fascinating to us. And we thought there's got to be a story there among those people who do that, because there's a cause here, there's a connection, there's also a stewardship care component for animals. And so we set up some interviews, we dug in and found it to be, it really exceeded our expectations when it came to generating insights about those very issues.
And I think there were some surprises along the way. The way Stuart described it, we didn't really set out to study work as a calling. It was very much focused on kind of like this cause, this ideology. We expected zookeepers to be, you know, very strong environmentalists, which they are, but that really proved to be secondary to what makes them tick. And when we started interviewing the zookeepers, we recognized what they were talking about was something that was very personal. It was a connection with their animals. And they were really the ones that kept using the word calling or words similar to that and steered us in that direction.
And I remember in the paper, you indicated even changing your interview protocol to kind of more directly address that topic of calling, given how frequently it was coming up in your initial interviews.
Yeah, our initial interviews were very broad. They were much broader, and they spent a lot of time talking about the sort of psychological contract that employees have with their organization. And we were delving into that. And this idea of calling kept coming up. And we thought, we can't understand this unless we really redirect and dig deeper into that concept of calling. And so you're right. It moved from something that maybe might be part of the story to really the central character.
Yeah, in a very kind of bottom-up way as opposed to top-down. So in the study, you talk a little bit about how zookeepers seem to understand calling, as you write, in a way that harkens back to the Protestant reformers and the way they talked about calling. What do you mean by that?
This one was just a lot of fun to learn about. We discovered in going way back that the idea that work could be anything but just kind of a necessary evil that you got out of the way as quickly as possible so that you could focus on more useful and meaningful and rewarding stuff, that's a pretty modern concept. If you go back to medieval times, work was just kind of, it was an evil that you tried to sort of slough off. The Greeks saw it as something that you found slaves to do, and that people who had better things to do with their life didn't bother wasting their life on work. It wasn't until the Protestant Reformation with Martin Luther and John Calvin that work sort of became something more than a necessary evil and actually became a divine offering. Martin Luther argued that we should see our work as our offering to the human family. So he used the example of the cobbler by making shoes that can cover human feet is actually serving humanity and therefore serving God. And John Calvin took it another step and said, well, and yes, that's true. And in looking for where you're making that contribution, look inward and find your own sort of gifts and your own abilities and find that place where those gifts and abilities can be used to benefit humanity. That's your offering to God. And by the way, that's your duty to God, is to find that. Mm-hmm. So that's a fundamental transformation in the way you think about work. Work, no matter what you do, no matter how menial, you can sort of find a way of crafting a story about how that work is really a contribution to the good of humankind. And Max Weber, the famous German sociologist, made that point. He wrote in about 1905, he wrote a famous book on the Protestant work ethic, where he argued that this concept that was introduced by Martin Luther and John Calvin has actually been imported into our modern world to justify putting our nose to the grindstone and working hard at whatever we're asked to do. Why? Because it's our offering to the broader human family. And so anyway, that's all background. Now here we are talking to zookeepers, and what we heard was something that sounded very, very similar. It wasn't this idea, oh, this is blissful, this is one. It's, look, I have these gifts. Here's a place where those gifts are needed. It's my duty. And as we heard that, and as we went back and read about the history of work, we couldn't help but hear echoes of John Calvin and Martin Luther in the way that zookeepers were talking about their work.
Let me just add to that. So Stuart's kind of taken us backward, looking forward to kind of contemporary work on calling. As we started discovering that calling was important to zookeepers, we started looking at how people talk about calling today, kind of in popular press. And what we saw was, it felt like a really anemic version of what the zookeepers were talking about. The idea that work should be, you know, that finding a calling means finding your dream job or finding work that feels like play. And it sort of didn't contain that level of devotion that we saw from the zookeepers. And speaking back to Max Weber, one of his great quotes is that the idea of calling prowls about in our lives like the ghost of dead religious beliefs. And he's kind of highlighting the fact that the contemporary version of calling has stripped away the offering piece. It's stripped away the sacrifice that's required to fulfill your duty to pursue a calling. And when we talk to the zookeepers, you know, very much a sense of duty and obligation, a lot of sacrifice, deep satisfaction in the work they do, but it doesn't come cheap.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So these really kind of themes from the 16th century that are rediscovered in this group of people working with big animals, cleaning out cages, that kind of thing, and kind of pairing the passion with this kind of obligation, duty, and sacrifice. And so that leads to the next question I had, because one of the things you discovered is that sense that for zookeepers, calling can be a double-edged sword, highly positive on the one hand, but with some pretty serious trade-offs on the other. Tell us a little bit about the pros and cons of approaching work as a calling in this way.
So on the pro side, a lot of things you might expect, lots of satisfaction, a deep sense of purpose and meaning. Zookeepers derive great joy from personal interaction with their animals, from seeing an endangered species, you know, bear young, to be there for a live birth. There are a lot of really happy stories when you talk to zookeepers about the positive side. On the negative side, I mentioned the word sacrifice. If you think about what these zookeepers do, they are out in the cold, they're out in the heat, they're dealing with substances that don't smell very good, to be polite. It's hard work, it's dangerous work. They don't get a lot of recognition. There's not really any upward mobility in a zookeeping career. So you're paying a big price to do that sort of work. And in addition, in our quantitative research, we found some really interesting patterns. Surprisingly, zookeepers that have a strong sense of calling were a little more critical of one another, perhaps more critical of management. And specifically, they tend to adopt kind of a strong moral sense about their work. So they see things in black and white. So managing someone with a calling may not necessarily be easy, even though they're highly motivated. They're also likely to be the greasy wheel that gets the grease.
Squeaky wheel.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Squeaky wheel that demands
like the greasy wheel.
Yeah. because they see everything in terms of moral absolutes. So yeah, there's definitely a strong dichotomy there in both some amazing positives for having a sense of calling, but also some complicating factors and personal sacrifices that go into it.
So I got to just add to that. Jeff mentioned earlier that as we were talking to zookeepers, the version of calling we saw just wasn't resonating with what we were reading in some of the contemporary descriptions by researchers about the idea of calling. So the first time I presented zookeepers, the first time we had ever taken this to anybody, it was a conference on meaningful work. And I presented this idea that calling had these two edges and that it was really, there's a sharp edge to calling, this idea of duty and moral responsibility. And this idea that, you know, if this is really your offering, then anything less than absolute sacrifice is not just a professional decision, it's a moral failure. And I presented that and it was like crickets, you know? People are just kind of looking at me and they're going, that's not how we think about calling. Calling is about finding your bliss. Calling is about you know, joy and ultimate fulfillment. How dare you? And it was really interesting to see how now these same people who were asking those questions became some of our biggest supporters in once they recognized what we were saying and realized that, yeah, this really is kind of an element of what we ended up calling a neoclassical calling. But it was something that was a little bit of a surprise to people who saw calling as kind of the ultimate in career meaningfulness and satisfaction. That's not necessarily the case. It may be the ultimate in meaning and purpose, but that doesn't mean it's always blissful and easy. It comes at a price, as Jeff said just a minute ago.
Yeah, we talk sometimes about, you know, the two traditions within well-being, eudaimonic and hedonic. And
right.
What you're talking about really speaks more to that eudaimonic type of well-being that focuses on personal growth, meaning, purpose, but sometimes a sense of meaning comes through trial. And, you know, hedonic well-being is more pleasure. And those two things aren't totally opposed to each other, but they're not the same thing either.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And we sort of backed into that.
Are zookeepers with a calling more vulnerable to exploitation from unscrupulous employers than zookeepers who don't have a calling, who have other motives?
Yeah, that actually was a fascinating finding here. I mean, imagine yourself sitting on a hay bale across from an elephant handler or in the back room of the gorilla house talking to somebody, and they kind of, in answering one of your questions, kind of look side to side and then say, you know, I love my job, but don't tell management that, because if they find that out, they're going to use that knowledge to, you know, pay us less or try and get more work out of us. In other words, they were very concerned that this deep passion they felt for their job could be used against them. And there's some evidence, Jeff pointed out in our empirical data, that that's exactly the case. Zookeepers who had a higher sense of calling also made a little less money in sort of self-reported income in this case. Now, the causality there, at least one explanation for that, is that there is some exploitation going on.
You can see how if you're a manager and you need somebody to clean out the rhinoceros cage, who are you going to ask? The employee who's going to complain and bristle against that and make your life miserable, or the one who's going to not love the work but not complain about it because they see the value in it? They're intrinsically motivated to create a clean environment.
Yeah, well, with limited resources, you don't have to give them a raise and you know they'll still stay.
Right.
Which is one of the potential explanations for a negative correlation between calling and salary.
So in fact, I think this was in one of Jeff's interviews where he asked one of the zookeepers, he said, so what would be grounds for divorce from the zoo? And she's like, you mean other than them firing me? She just couldn't comprehend what would possibly get her to leave. Do you recall that conversation, Jeff?
I do. Yeah, that was with the scorpion expert.
That's right.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, just the implications for the organization then, and talk a little bit about that. What does this mean in terms of how organizations might recruit or select or manage their people?
So I think that there's a danger because calling has these dual edges. Recruiting for calling is also a double-edged sword for management. On one hand, you're getting highly dedicated workers who are willing to sacrifice, who are willing to come in at all hours, who are going to put up with things that may not be ideal. On the other hand, because they have a very strong commitment to a specific representation of what it means to work there. In other words, there's an ideology, there's a cause, there's a purpose. Let's talk zookeepers. They believe that these animals need to be taken care of and that the zoo should be just as committed to the animals and to biodiversity as the zookeepers are. If management falls short of that in the eyes of the zookeepers, there's not a lot of patience for that. So the zookeepers will hold management to a very high standard, a standard that's implied by the very high standard to which they hold themselves, this kind of moral obligation, this moral duty. We found that the correlation between the moral duty that a zookeeper feels about their work and the extent to which they feel that the zoo has a moral duty was really tight, very high correlation between those two. Mm.
So if you're a manager, then it kind of raises the bar. If you've got a team of employees with a calling, you have to make sure that you're on your game, because they're going to expect a lot because they care so much about it.
Yeah, and let me share just one quick story with you about that point. So here in St. Louis, we have a world-class zoo. You know, zoo directors have these competing goals. On one hand, they do believe in the cause of global biodiversity and caring for these animals. On the other hand, they're running a business. So they got to get people in the door and they've got to increase revenue. And by increasing revenue, they're better able to provide for those animals. And so there's sort of this competing goals that they're operating with. So the zoo director here in St. Louis, you know, you get people in the door with things like little trains that run around and those sorts of things, not just the animals. And so he wanted to add a carousel and thought carousel, kids will come. People will bring their kids, not just to look at the animals, but also just to ride the carousel. This will be great. And he announced this to the zookeepers and they just went crazy. And they said, we already have a train. You're going to turn us into some sort of an amusement park here. This is crazy. What are you doing? This is insane. We can't do this. This is a serious conservation institution. We're not a carnival. And so his solution to that was to introduce the carousel under the name Conservation Carousel, and by promising that a portion of the proceeds from the Conservation Carousel would go to conservation causes worldwide. And it was a brilliant solution, and it was a legitimate way of sort of resolving that tension between the zookeepers who are holding management to a very high standard and management who they have an obligation to something other than just caring for the welfare of those animals.
That's fantastic. What a creative way to kind of find common ground on something and to the benefit of everyone. Related to this double-edged sword, from the individual's perspective, whether you're a zookeeper or, you know, work in any other line, if a calling can both be very positive, but then also have some trade-offs, how can a person ensure, or what steps can they take to ensure that the work they do within their calling is more likely to lead to the positives as opposed to the negatives? Now, some of this you describe in a book that you've published called The Zookeeper's Secret. So tell us a little bit about, first of all, what was your goal for that book?
Great question. First, I want to kind of challenge the premise of your question. How do we maximize the positives and minimize the negatives? I'm all for people being happy at work and enjoying the work that they do. But there is something ennobling about the sacrifices that zookeepers were able to make. I believe that they experienced a calling, not in spite of the sharp edge of the sword, but in some ways precisely because of it, because they're willing to invest, willing to sweat, bleed, and cry for their animals. That work becomes something that is reverential, something that's deeply meaningful. And I would hate to convey to someone, oh yeah, there's a way that your work can be happy all the time, and we can get rid of all of the negatives, all of the offerings, because that's really the source of the meaning. Losing oneself in a great cause is sometimes the means for finding yourself.
Absolutely.
So I can see how, from an individual perspective, the embracing the toil and the hardship can be generative and transforming personally. So I like that. I can see how it'd be a slippery slope from the management side of things. Like, these hardships are good for you people. You know, you should, this is for your own good. You should embrace it for that reason.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons that exploitation is such a concern, because that can definitely happen. I don't want to push too hard on that notion that you got to suffer for your job.
Yeah.
But I do think when we don't invest with sacrifice, it's harder for us to develop the sense of devotion that zookeepers had. Back to the other part of your question, the reason for the book. And this book is probably worth noting. It's a faith-based account of calling. We draw heavily upon our research. But what I discovered personally, I suspect Stuart would feel the same, is that talking about finding one's calling becomes pretty much a spiritual pursuit. I mean, you ask deep core identity issues about who am I and what legacy do I want to leave and what do I stand for? And so I never set out to write a book. That wasn't the goal. But it was sort of like this research became so personal for me, so urgent, that I kind of had to write it. And I wanted to start this book with Stuart's collaboration in a way, just to kind of express something that we were deeply feeling and wanted to put into words. So the goal of the book is actually to be fairly practical, in some ways almost a workbook, for activities you can undertake that helps you develop that sense of you know, what are my passions? What makes me tick? What are the causes that call to me? What have my life experiences prepared me and predisposed me to be able to give and to offer? That's kind of the genesis of the book as I see it. I'd love to have Stuart chime in on that too.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the case. We've talked about for some time about writing a book that would be sort of for practitioners, a little more accessible. And this felt like a really nice way to go about it, in part because it was part of the conversations that we had as we were thinking about calling. The papers that we've written for academic audiences certainly don't have any of that element there. But yeah, in terms of our conversations about this broader concept and how it applies to us, it's hard to have that conversation without folding in sort of the whole person. And that includes who we are as spiritual beings.
We still want to write that general practitioner book. So we'll see if we can get our act together and do that.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are social science scholars, and there's a science behind this, but it doesn't reduce to scientific principles, does it? There's this, you kind of started talking about Luther and Calvin and some of these great theologians, and there's this really robust kind of spiritual insight that is just hard to completely separate from a scientific understanding of this phenomenon.
That came out in our data as well. One of the themes that came from our interviews that was really surprising, I think, to both of us, what we ended up calling a sense of destiny. So zookeepers would very consistently say, you know, I felt guided to be here. Like, things worked out the way they were supposed to. It felt like magic. They were giving these sort of almost cosmic attributions for how things worked out the way that they did. It's worth noting, not a single interview that I remember talked about religion per se, but there was a deep sense of, you know, among this secular group of people, they had somehow been fortuitous and guided, that the hand of fate had smiled upon them. Can a hand smile on someone? The fate had smiled upon them. So to me, that was a manifestation of a sense of spirituality about work that didn't reduce to a particular religious tradition.
You mentioned Calvin. Calvin had talked and written about people having, as part of their design, this sensus divinitatis, you know, the sense of the divine as part of being human. And so it sounds like you were kind of picking up on this sort of search for a deeper meaning beyond the mundane.
It's really built into the very roots of the calling concept, right? I mean, it comes from the Protestant Reformation. A sense of the word calling, you know, vocare in Latin, or beruf in German, as Max Weber talked about it. It's this idea that there's a caller, that you're being called by someone or something. And over the years, that's evolved, from you're being called by God to do this work, to I'm being called by the human family. But there's still this idea of some external summons, and to get there requires kind of a broader view of who we are and what our responsibilities are.
I'm curious, do you guys think of your own work as a calling?
Yeah, absolutely. This has been one where, as we've gone back and forth, we both absolutely see our work as a calling, but not in the same way. And there are different dimensions to how we think about our calling. For me, I feel like I am called to be a researcher, a scholar, and a professor. And that part of what I'm doing is I'm helping people to find meaning and clarity in their work and in their work lives. That's kind of the core of my calling. Jeff has another layer, and I'll let him talk about that.
I don't know if it's another layer, but it's probably a different manifestation. So I find my calling more in the classroom than in research. I enjoy research, and I see it as a means by which I am more able to impact people. But for me, the experience of standing in a classroom or mentoring a student who is having these sort of existential questions about who am I and where am I going, I feel really called and connected with people at that stage of life and with those sort of questions. I feel it's a calling, and I'm grateful, and I can't imagine doing anything else.
Jeff, what I was actually referring to, though, when I talk about another layer, is a debate that we had. So what you talked about sort of being called in the classroom, I think I can relate to that. But as we had this conversation, you talked about place, this idea of place, and that for you, a big part of your calling is the specific university for which you work. Okay. Am I right?
Yeah, so that it harks back to the destiny comment that I made earlier. We sort of are equating destiny with a sense of place. Like, where has life brought you? And for me, I have the opportunity to teach at an institution of higher learning that's also a faith-based institution, and it weaves together multiple pieces of my deepest convictions, I guess. And so, although I have always loved teaching and coaching students at other institutions, there is something different about being here in a university where faith can be an open part of the dialogue as well.
That's exactly it. I still remember sitting in this little conference room trying to dimensionalize calling for this book on Zookeeper's Secret, and Jeff kept coming back to this is a part of his calling, the place where he was, and that was a critical part. And so we actually ended up folding that into the framework that we provide in that book about how you find your calling, is that place might be an element of varying importance in the way that you think about.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, as all three of us are academics, and one of the great benefits of an academic lifestyle is freedom. To a certain extent, all three of us, I think, have the opportunity to think really integratively and to pull together in our work and in the way we carry it out, all these different aspects of who we are. But it's something different when you're at an institution that really values and supports all aspects of that integration. Whereas, you know, as a person of faith in a public research university, I still have the freedom to pull together my own faith perspective in the work that I do, but I have to be just really thoughtful about how I present that given the context that I'm in and the rules that govern it and so
right.
forth.
Yeah, well put. So
before we kind of talk about this recent conference that you did, I had one other question, and it's easy when you're talking about how calling is defined to really get deep into the weeds. And so I don't necessarily want to do that, but you guys published another pretty important paper recently in the Annual Review of Organizational Psychology and Organizational Behavior. Where you kind of review the current state of organizational behavior research on calling, and you make a series of recommendations. And one of the things you address in there touches on one of the themes that we've talked a little bit about in this interview, and that is how calling is defined and how scholars come down in different places regarding, you know, what they emphasize and the way they understand it. You know, so you mentioned the kind of neoclassical versus modern, the external summons or sense of duty or destiny, as opposed to, or not necessarily as opposed to, this is part of your answer maybe, but a kind of alongside that sense of passion within a life domain. And you advocate a kind of both and approach that you refer to as a transcendent calling. Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by that transcendent calling in this context?
Yeah, so this actually, that idea and even that term comes from Abraham Maslow. And as we know, Maslow is often recognized as one of the fathers of modern psychology. And Maslow is perhaps best known for the hierarchy of needs, the pyramid of human needs that sort of works up from physiological needs to safety needs. And at the very top of that pyramid, Maslow proposes would be self-actualization needs. In other words, you sort of have actualized your full potential. What people don't know as much about Maslow is that in his later years, he actually added another level after self-actualization, and he called it self-transcendence, which is sort of getting beyond this sort of obsessive focus on the self and seeing what you're doing more as an offering. And so we got curious about that and did some reading about some of Maslow's writings on this topic. And he makes this really interesting point that those people who had achieved this state of kind of self-transcendence, there were two elements that he found as he interviewed them. One was what he called this idea of inner requiredness, this sense that I just have this inner drive to do this kind of work. I gotta paint, I gotta write, whatever it might be. But they also had another sense that he called outer requiredness, which is this sense that there's something out there that my gifts are particularly suited to serve, some problem that my gifts and my talents, my drive is uniquely suited to address. And so Maslow argues that the marriage of those two things, of kind of inner requiredness and outer requiredness, that's kind of when you achieve this state that goes beyond self-actualization. And in writing about this, he said, you know, you could even use the term calling to talk about this if you wanted. He didn't call it a calling, but he said, you know, this is kind of where that old term calling might be most relevant, is talking about people who have this sense of inner and outer requiredness that leads to self-transcendence. As we sort of thought about these dichotomy in the field between the what really are views of calling that are about inner requiredness and views of calling that are about outer requiredness, that maybe Maslow gave us a nice way out, that even there may be sort of pure forms of either one, but the combination of the two may be the most powerful. And that's when you go beyond just a focus on self and self-actualization to see what you're doing as a broader kind of offering. That's the transcendence element. Your fellow man's accomplishing something that's bigger than yourself.
I love that. And I loved it when I read it, because you can see the kind of integrative potential of approaching things that way, where it allows flexibility for people to have these different emphases with how they understand calling, but put them within this broader kind of outer directedness and inner directedness context that to me has unifying potential. So thanks to both of you for advancing that idea.
Oh, I'm glad it resonates.
Tell us about this recent research conference that you held in St. Louis. It was this very unique event, very small, and structured in a unique way. A typical academic conference consists of lots of formal lectures, PowerPoint presentations of new research findings. This was very different. It was structured really like a series of conversations. What were you hoping to accomplish with this conference, and in particular by structuring it the way that you did?
There are probably a few different answers to that question, but I think for me, most fundamentally, this is a community. It's a small community of scholars all interested in calling. There's a lot of, I think, has always been a friendship and a positive feeling, but it's a lot of sort of like ships passing in the night kind of thing. You know, we'd see each other at conferences and, you know, maybe hear one another's papers. But when you're in the academy and you know, there are thousands of people around, it's really hard to settle in and have deep conversations. So I think my driving interest was just to have some quiet time for these folks to get together and talk and make sense collectively, because there are differences in how we define. And, you know, it would have been nice if we'd all come together and, you know, and suddenly we had a consensus emerge out of the meeting. We didn't anticipate that was very likely among, you know, a bunch of smart people who've given a lot of thought to a phenomenon. I really hoped that we could open a dialogue and continue the level of respect we had, but also to sort of tackle in a very civil and productive way some of the differences that surround our research.
I guess maybe the only thing that I would add is I think part of the motivation here is that both Jeff and I believe that the concept of work as a calling really is one of the most fundamental and potentially powerful concepts in the field of organizational behavior and in understanding how individuals relate to their work and sort of rise above. In fact, you could argue that the concept of work is in just, we just went through this history of the Protestant Reformation and Max Weber and how this idea of work as a calling goes all the way back to the 16th century. You could argue that the idea that work could be a calling may be one of the oldest concepts in all of literature on the study of work. I don't know that there are very many concepts in the field of organizational behavior have that sort of distinguished history. And yet, I think it's probably fair to say that the concept of work as a calling has struggled to get traction in top-tier management journals. There have not been the kinds of publications and growth in publications among the journals that we write in as management scholars that we would like to see. And part of the reason for that is that people are writing about it in different ways, and they have different ways of thinking about it and different ways of defining it. And so we thought, well, that may be our own faults. How often have we really talked to one another? I mean, do we really have a sense of community here about, you know, these people who are all studying a similar topic? And then that all of the things that Jeff said about getting people together and talking and being open and not assuming that, you know, that we're there to kind of push a view or advance any one person's conceptualization, all those came into play. And we thought, let's get together and let's, goal number one, create a community that can work on this problem together and really realize the potential of this really powerful construct.
Those are very powerful goals and really important given the state of work on this area. To what extent do you feel those goals were met? You know, having a few months to reflect on the event, what do you see as the kind of lasting legacy of that conference, or, you know, the takeaways or the challenges, opportunities? Somehow I made this a very convoluted question, but reflect a little bit as you think back on that event. And, you know,
well, I would say that goal number one was absolutely met, and that was to bring people together, to have an honest, open conversation, and to create a sense of community. And so one of the things that came out of this is we all know one another. We know how to reach one another. There's a discussion group that was created to sort of share insights and ask questions as we're moving forward with our research. And I think that's the most important thing we accomplished. I think we did accomplish that. Did we resolve debates? I don't think so. We highlighted some of the needs, but I think we mostly really came to an understanding of where people are coming from and greased the skids so that dialogue around these issues can proceed. I know that there were at least a couple of groups that formed from this that are getting together to work on some problems that were raised in the conference, and hopefully that will result in some good work that we see in coming years.
Part of solving problems is getting people together and getting them on the same page regarding what the challenges are. And I definitely sense that that was accomplished. And building relationships that can turn into new collaborations is also just a huge win. And I can just speak personally as a participant in that conference, the level of energy and excitement about this field that I took back with me has been really sustaining. And so I'm grateful to you guys for having the vision. One last question. I was asking about takeaways from that conference. Speaking of takeaways, a lot of the listeners of this podcast are not scholars who work at a university and plan studies and analyze data. They're people from all walks of life, students, people working for themselves, working for organizations, looking for work, caregiving, navigating retirement. I know it's really impossible and unfair for me to ask you to give blanket recommendations that kind of apply across such a range of contexts. But what are some key pieces of advice that you would give listeners who want to experience more out of their work?
The one that immediately comes to mind, and this is kind of my go-to regardless of what stage of career someone is at, having a sense of calling entails a deep understanding of one's gifts. And that comes all the way from John Calvin. And the exercise that I have students do is to inventory their childhood. Because when you're a kid, that's probably the purest expression of your interests. No one's telling you what to do. And so the way you play as a child, I think, often gives really key clues as to what your gifts are and what makes you tick. And I will do this every semester with my students and have students think really deeply. And I ask them to be very specific. You know, if I liked sports is not a good enough answer. I want to know what kind of sport, what sort of role did you play? Was it structured sport or was it a casual sporting activity? If you like to tell stories, what types of stories were they? When we really drill down in those specifics, it's just so much fun to see light bulbs come on. And almost without fail, I've got people that kind of go, oh, I see now. I've always been this type of person. I think one of the things that is revelatory about that is that our natural gifts, because they're natural, we often undervalue them. We see them as just something it's just what I would do. It's just a normal thing. When you get really specific, you recognize that those gifts that seem normal are actually really special, really unique, and often they have market value that you may not recognize. And so that activity, I think of all the ones I do in class, and there are a number I do, but that is the one that I think generates the most insight among people.
The one thing that came to mind when you asked that question, Brian, for me was a lot of people would answer that question in a very simplistic way by saying, follow your bliss, right? That's maybe one of the most common prescriptions for how you find meaningful work. Follow your bliss, just follow your bliss. And if there's one message from the research and writing that Jeff and I have done together, it's that that's bad advice. Following your bliss is bad advice. In fact, there's a story that I think Jeff originally keyed me onto this, but Joseph Campbell was a writer who talked about hero myths, and he's actually the one who coined that term, follow your bliss. And people sort of grabbed a hold of that, and it appeared on t-shirts, and it appeared on posters, and usually with peace signs and all that, you know. So this idea of follow your bliss became pretty widely known. And he was giving a talk later in his career, and he said, you know, I kind of regret that I said that, because what I probably should have said instead of follow your bliss is follow your blisters. In other words, instead of just following those things that make you blissfully happy, the way you can tell those things that are really going to give you a sense of fulfillment and happiness and purpose in your life is to pay attention to those things that you're willing to sacrifice for. And those things that you're willing to struggle and sacrifice for and pay a price for, that's where you're going to find something that's going to be truly meaningful in the eudaimonic sense of sort of fulfilling, purposeful, meaningful work. So that may be, I think, if you look at a consistent theme across the things that Jeff and I have been writing about, that may be one. Follow your blisters, don't follow your bliss.
That reminds me of another one that's related. This is rooted in personal experience. You mentioned that I worked for Payless. I'll be honest, I was very unhappy during that time. It was not my calling, and I was pretty miserable. And what I did as a result of being miserable there was to kind of like turn within myself. I tried to do my job and do it well enough that I'd, you know, be able to get another job, and just kind of like waiting by the phone for the next opportunity. And in hindsight, I look back on that and realize it was really a stupid response to being in that setting. What I wish I had done is to say, okay, not happy here. I'm not loving this place. That probably means there are other people around me are having the same experience. Can I help them? Can I find a way in this context that's not ideal to serve, to make things better, to go, instead of withdrawing, to go above and beyond? Because if I did, two things would happen. First, I would discover what my strengths were, because our strengths reveal themselves most in the face of adversity and challenge. But second, other people would have seen what my strengths were. And I'm convinced that opportunities would have come to me more quickly to find the right path. I worry about this a lot with my students who are kind of really keen on finding the right job when they get out of school. I tell them, you know, based on my experience, getting a bad job is not the worst thing that will ever happen to you. It may be an opportunity for you, if you're willing to extend yourself, to find out what really matters, to find out who you aren't, which is part of the equation of finding out who you are. So that's advice I would give to anyone who feels stuck in a job or feels like they're in a place where they, you know, they don't feel they belong. Ironically, I think it's a matter of giving more than giving less that will unstick you.
Such high value advice. Thanks so much, you guys. We're out of time, so we're going to wrap up here. Our guests today have been Dr. Stuart Bunderson from Washington University in St. Louis and Jeff Thompson from Brigham Young University. Thank you, Stuart and Jeff, for being on the podcast. So grateful.
It's a pleasure, Brian. And thank you for the good work you do in this field as well. It's wonderful to have you as a colleague.
Yeah, and I would say one of the great outcomes from our conference and bringing people together is getting to know you. I mean, I'd read your work for years. I knew your papers and I knew your arguments. And yet now I know you and I know this good, warm human being that we've been chatting with for the last hour.
Well, you're very kind. I'd just say everything is more fun and more meaningful when it unfolds within a community.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, absolutely. The feeling is mutual. Getting to know you guys and count you as colleagues and friends has been a real joy. So thank you. And thank you, listeners, for tuning into this episode of the Purposeful Work Podcast. The Purposeful Work Podcast is brought to you by Pathway U. Learn more at pathwayu.com. And as a thank you for listening to this episode, Pathway U is offering a 20% off coupon code. When you check out, simply enter the code PurposePod. I'm your host, Brian Dick. We'll see you next time.